good result. And we're going to move to the next session. The session is on the BCUCCs. And I'd like to introduce Raghava
Tirumala.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure.
Good morning, Anne. At its June 2014 meeting, the IASB tentatively decided to give priority to considering business combinations under common control that involve third parties, such as prospective investors or existing non-controlling interests. And we think that understanding the information needs of investors is very important before we assess the various accounting alternatives for the transactions. Now, we have considered two scenarios of business combinations under common control and compared those with similar transactions that are not under common control. And for the sake of convenience, I propose that we discuss the two comparative scenarios separately and not mix them together. In the first scenario, we are essentially looking at IPO of a group entity. And what we are comparing is a transaction in which a group restructuring was needed to prepare a group entity for IPO versus a transaction where the group entity was ready for.
Had left the conference.
We're still with you.
Versus a transaction where a group entity is ready in its current form for IPO and no restructuring was needed. The questions we have there is, if a group restructuring was required to prepare a group entity for an IPO, what sort of information do investors need? I mean, as if the new group always existed historically, or should the financial information be prepared as if the old group existed as it was, and the restructuring is accounted for from the date the restructuring happened? And if you think that the accounting should be as if the restructuring is accounted from the date it actually happened, do you see fair value as a relevant information in those transactions? If yes, would you like the fair values to be recognized on the financial statements or just a disclosure?
Those were two questions.
Yeah.
Peter's going to answer.
I was actually looking at exactly this sort of structure not long ago, and the company had made some attempts to present pro forma information to our analysts and others involved in the transaction. They only managed to present sort of one historic balance sheet, say from the previous period, and three periods of pro forma sort of P&L information and a little bit of cash flow. So it was a bit of a smorgasbord, and not a good one, going back to Jacques' sort of Michelin guide analogy. But I think in an ideal world, I think it would be better to see a business as though it had always existed, rather than to actually sort of have the sort of consolidation accounting fair value process effectively breaking the time series. So in an ideal world, you'd want to be able to sort of say, okay, well, this is the business I'm buying. I want to be able to analyse the trends that it's had historically as a private business in its current structure and sort of look back. Now, you may appreciate that you're looking back at, to an extent, a fiction, because it didn't really exist that way, but that's the most useful basis from which you're then going to forecast. And of course, that's the key, particularly in this sort of IPO transaction, your scenario you're setting out. As an investor, you are trying to get a sense of how will this business fare in the public market, and what will happen to my money if I put my money into it.
I'd like to follow up on that, because if we don't get the information in the way Peter requested, we need to try to do the combination analysis ourselves. So what we do is, it's quite difficult, very time consuming, and we have a huge disadvantage, because we don't know enough information, is to do a combination analysis, I think, take into account at what was the consummation date, is there seasonality, how do you account for that, all kinds of problems that you need to take into account to get to the start point for your analysis. And then it's only the start point, because then you need, the start point is as if the business has always was combined already, and that's what you want to, because that's the start point for projection. The comments that Peter makes, actually, I think they are valid for a broader context than just business combination and common control. They hook into entire IFRS 3, I think. It's too bad that that analysts lose so much time in everybody trying to make those combination analyses, because there are an awful lot of acquisitions, and it makes their life really difficult, which means there's like an accounting uncertainty maybe for 1.5 years before you get a clean, you know, 100% owned, 100% a clean financial statement to where you can really more or less rely on. And then a month later they do an acquisition again, you know? It's acquisitions are a major cause of risk, a major cause, and it's very difficult to analyze. And to some extent, the current way acquisitions are accounted for are not helping us in the best way possible. Are any comments on this from other members?
I agree with Peter, not I. And maybe that was what you were aiming at, but if that was the case, I really didn't understood it. But if I have a group from another group, to me it's very important, and normally it is acquired over the last 10 years or so. It's important that I look at figures that also includes like goodwill and intangibles from the acquisitions. I don't want to look at the trend in a company with return on capital employed of 56% in average, because I know that is not forward-looking. I want to know also the surpluses and everything that comes through the acquisition, and that is important to me. Which leads up to the second question. If I can't get that, I am definitely interested in the market values. I don't want to have a company, again, with a tremendously high return on capital, because they have written down everything that is possible to write down. I want a balance sheet that reflects some kind of reality, and that is kind of market value, more than historical cost.
So just a question on that. If you look at the scenario that we've considered here, where IP1 is acquiring S2, if I understand your question, are you saying that the acquisition of S2 has to be at fair values so that you get to know the goodwill and the fair values of the assets of S2 in this transaction?
Yes.
I disagree. Can I just clarify, because you kind of said that you also want to have IFRS 3-type information. So are you saying that you want both methods in that particular scenario? So you want to see the group as if it always existed, and you want to see fair values, or does one trump the other?
Well, you use fair values. I like to talk about goodwill and other intangibles, because that is normally what I see. The other fair values are inventory and other stuff. It's not really relevant. I want to see the group, because it has been acquired over the years. So I want to see the group that way. I don't want to have all the goodwill taken away from that group that will be introduced on the market.
Peter, I'm not sure that's what's being suggested, though, is it? I think what's being suggested here is...
I have trouble understanding these boxes, actually. So this is my view. I give you that. Going back to the previous discussion.
Because this is talking about a transaction within a group,
yeah. Okay,
as within, opposed to what you're talking about, okay, where the group is buying in businesses and you will get goodwill in that.
Okay.
This is a very specific transaction.
Then I understand. I need to think that through.
Yes, just to echo what Peter Owen said, I think in this scenario that you've described, definitely want to see the group as if it's always existed. I think that's really important in terms of trend analysis and kind of forecasting the future. And you probably know this already, but I think in the UK listing environment, there is that requirement to have this trend analysis and this carve-out financial statement. So There's a, I think it's an accounting standard, but kind of an accounting standard, CER 2000, and that kind of sets out the financial statements have to give that historic view, and that's what you see in UK prospectuses, and I think it works very, very well.
Okay. Thank you, Oswald.
I've been analyzing the input of the analysts, and it's important that I think we need to make something. We're hearing several trends here. Analysts had an incredible time dealing with an acquisition. So some of the comments are basically relate to any business combination. We want this historical information because we need it for the trends in the models. And then we have Peter who says, oh, by the way, we have this issue that if you're doing a whole bunch of acquisitions, if you do the acquisitions at historical cost, you then get an employed capital number that's completely wrong. And so you're teasing out these two comments, which would apply to any transaction, even between two publicly traded companies. So you need to sort of parse out that. And then the question, of course, then I think in that context, what may be the question you should be asking is, do we believe the fair values? And I'm not sure what my colleagues would say, but I think that what the answer you're going to get for these scenarios is basically around, do you think the fair value number has any usefulness or not? But even if we thought the fair value was a useful number, we're still going to ask you for trend information because we need it to do the models. I'll stop there.
Okay. Go
ahead.
Yeah, like the other colleagues, I do prefer the historical information. And we need, as many other people said, that we need some kind of trend information so that cost is more relevant than fair value. But fair value information, that the probably that not should be enough. And also that if we have this information on the primary financial statement, I would rather concern that the parent companies can exploit this kind of transaction to make IPO much better. And this kind of manipulation could happen so that I believe that the cost information should be better and relevant measurement here.
Okay, thank you.
I don't really have much new to add, so I'll just sort of lend my support to the idea that it should be at historical cost. I think trying to assign fair value to a transaction that's clearly not arm's length is just fraught with potential problems, and you're going to have a company going through an IPO that doesn't really represent the actual fair value of the company. It's just not a real number. So what's the point of fair value if you're not going to arrive at real fair value? I think it's just fraught with problems. Historical cost isn't perfect, but it seems like a better option in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kane?
Well, I sort of share the views of, so that's a big tick for 1A, and I'm like Osman, a fan of the prospectus formats, which is the sort of three-year trends and so on. I'm interested in whether you're doing a bit of experimenting with sort of ideas about fair valuings internal assets in this way. Because if you were going to get to a point where you were valuing internally generated intangibles, and this does address the problem that Peter's raised about balance sheets for many companies being unrealistic. A gap between net assets and market value being so big, so you think, well, are the balance sheets realistic? So is this a sort of little foray into the way that I've seen somebody suggest that you would do internally generated goodwill, which is that you'd set up sort of internal transactions, model them in order to arrive at it. So is it a fishing expedition?
I mean, we haven't still gone to the extent of that thought. I mean, that we should be allowing internally generated goodwills to get recognized on business combinations under common control. So we haven't really reached that stage yet.
Okay.
But then maybe just an accounting comment that when you look at the acquirer and the acquirer financial statements, from their perspective, it's not really internal. It's internal from the entire group perspective, but not at the level of consolidation we are talking about.
I just want to answer the correct question, and I do not want to have the S2 company revalued.
You don't want to?
No. My situation was different.
I mean, okay.
This is a situation I haven't really come across, actually. So,
if I understood your comment, what you're trying to say is that if S2 was acquired somewhere historically, it was not part of the group before and it was acquired. So you would like to see those goodwill, the goodwill numbers and the fair value numbers to the new subgroup which is getting created now.
So that is kind of historical cost.
Okay, Peter, thank you.
I just wanted to observe, maybe in the same note as Peter, that in the scenario in page 4, the box after string, it is possible that S2, if it was revalued to fair value, is the only part of the business which has been revalued, because S1 might have been acquired very long ago, or maybe created by the group, so there is no goodwill, no intangibles on S1. IP1 maybe has no intangibles, no goodwill, and only S2 would have a revaluation in that case. So is it useful for you to have a group with only part of it being at current value and most of the original part being at the way it is? Probably not. Now, I wanted to comment on to ask your view on the trend information in 3 years or 5 years, which is currently in many countries required by market regulators. Should we bring it into IFRS? Is that the message we should get from you, that you want this regulated information required by market authorities to become part of IFRS requirements?
Pro forma.
Actually, the 5 years of trend, 5 years, 3 years is pro forma. It doesn't exist in real life. It's just a construct for the purpose of informing you.
It would raise the minimum level of information significantly. I think,
Is that your message to us?
I think three years is valid. I think 5 years is too large.
Okay,
too much.
Right.
I agree.
But it's currently non-IFRS. It is outside. So we should take it on.
Yeah, I think it should be included.
Steve? Any other, sorry, this was a direct question. Any other sound questions from people on the direct question? 3 years?
Not 3 years.
Okay, Steve.
I was going to ask about book value. So you're saying that S2 after the restructuring, the assets in there should be at the book value, same as they were before the restructuring. What if when IP2 acquired S2 originally, goodwill arose on that combination, and IP2 has some goodwill in its balance sheet? Would you transfer that goodwill over, or would that be lost?
Peter's comment was exactly that goodwill should have now come into the new subgroup.
Yes.
It's part of the historical cost at that point.
Okay.
And if you're in the US, push down accounting, you've effectively pushed those down and then use carryovers. We don't have push down accounting. So that's one of the questions people ask, which carryover amounts. And that's something we clarify.
Okay.
Did you ask?
Yeah.
Just a small comment. As a lawyer, I can't help but also seeing the dark side of the force. I've seen lots of restructurings that had no other purpose but to generate internal goodwill that in our country, up to a certain limit, could be or still can be amortized for tax purposes. So the moment you create this goodwill on this transaction, you're going to see that based on the amended standard, you're going to see lots of restructurings all over the world just with the purpose of, in plain English, beefing up your balance sheets.
It boosts equity.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay. We can move on to the second set.
And the second comparative scenario is about an existing listed subsidiary which is undertaking transactions. So one is a transaction which is not under common control, so which is within the scope of IFRS 3, which the entity would account for using the acquisition method. And the comparative transaction is it acquires another entity from within the group, which is outside the scope of IFRS 3. So I'm comparing these two. Would the information needs of users be the same? I mean, would the users expect even a business combination under common control to be accounted for using the equity method? Or are the needs any different?
So in one scenario, S3 used to be part of the group, and another one is just a completely external
company.
That's the distinction.
Yeah. Okay,
Robert.
I'm struggling with the whole. I'm struggling with the whole line of questioning because you're saying, you're asking me, are the users' needs different? And I think the answer is users' needs are not different in acquisitions. We're trying to figure out what the fair value is to the, because we want to capture it as an asset employed. We're trying to figure out what the trends are, so we want historical information. And the approach you're trying to say, well, what are the user needs? Unfortunately, I think you're going to come up with a fairly boring answer. We have very similar needs in these cases. And my understanding is this is a particular problem, these type of transactions. And we're not going to be able to help you decide what is the right answer, I'm afraid. Except maybe the comment you heard earlier about if it's not a market transaction, you don't think it should be fair value should be there because it's a made up fair value. You want to disagree with me?
Well, I think here we can conclude that the one is a market transaction, the other one is not. That's the distinguishment. So the example here is, the question is, do you want to record goodwill on a market transaction? I think most of us would agree that if you have a market transaction, you would record goodwill because it's not at arm's length. So I think that's the distinguishment here. And in the scenario 2A, 3 was part of the group, and you have no guarantee whatsoever whether the market price that was whether the price paid was a arm's length price. Whereas
when you hope it is, given the 30% public holding,
yeah, they've got no control, but they're just sort of riding on.
Then the lesser factor should be duty on the part of the management.
So to your question, I actually spent.
I'm sorry, but this is I have no. My initial answer is that there is a fiduciary duty, but in practice there are so many. I think it's there's sufficient control to.
So to echo that comment, when the paper was written, you structured this paper so that the 30% meant that there was a presumption that it was a fair market, that it was a market transaction. So to the extent that it's a market transaction, fine. But I looked at that 30% and wondered, some jurisdictions, there's enough minority control rights that it would be a market transaction, but I'm not sure that it's true for all of the IFRS world. So I'm not sure 30% is the limit, at least on a global scale. In Delaware, it is. I'm not sure about the rest of the world.
There it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But should the accounting depend on whether it's an arm's length transaction?
I think it should. I think that is the fair value is now a market fair value versus it's a level 1 fair value versus a level 3 fair value. Yeah.
Can I just dig a little bit into this? Because the concern that I hear is that the transaction price might not necessarily be a market price, which is, I think, a valid concern, could be a valid concern. But then I think there are two separate questions. One question is, okay, in a business combinations under common control, do I recognize acquired assets and liabilities at fair value? So that's the first question. And then the second question, any difference between the transaction price and those fair values, what do I do with that? Is it appropriate to recognize goodwill or not? Is it appropriate to recognize intangible assets or not? is it appropriate to recognize a gain in such transaction? So I'm trying to understand, is this just the transaction price itself that is a concern, which has implications on goodwill, or are you saying that you wouldn't want fair values of the acquired assets? Am I clear or not?
I think in a common control transaction, I think there's some doubt about whether the fair values are fair values, because it's not truly arm's length. I think that's the underlying concern, right? So it's not so much about the goodwill, it's the reliability of that fair value transaction, despite the 30% that external parties may own.
First, actually, a tax comment.
Yes, the other important point of this question is whether or not you would like to have a financial statement from the eye of the 30% public traded shareholders. I mean, which is the minority. So although it's a minority, but it's a public traded, and public investors are investing into the IP1. So then, from the eyes of those minority shareholders, they don't really care who is the other company. So they want to know as if it is a standalone corporate group. Do you think this kind of view is important? Or if you look at the total group as a P group, so then it is a totally internal transaction. So then,
I see your distinction.
Yeah, there is a distinction. So then, question is, so if the, from the viewpoint of the shareholders of IP1, which is the 30% shareholder, then the IP1 group is the, single group. But from the viewpoint of shareholders of P, then that is the different group.
Yeah.
So then the question is, for the IP1, you could have different financial statement, but this is the part of the financial statement of P group.
Yeah.
So that is the difficulty of this project.
Yeah, but I think this is, I see the problem, everybody is, I think it's I would not regard it as, if you agree that it's the reporting for a group, and the parent of a group, that there's a distinction, I should not walk away from. I don't think you should walk away from that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's not, it's not a problem in itself that the IP1 records goodwill and P does not record goodwill.
That's so different, different information.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If I look at the acquisition of S3 from IP1, which has 30% public ownership, in Sweden this is heavily regulated. Well, of course, if IP1 acquires S3 from the parent company at a too high price, it's a poor company, but still we pay a premium or whatever. That means that it will be a transfer of values from one party to another. So I cannot really think of the situation where the price should not reflect the market value, because it is so heavily regulated and gone.
Dan,
my concern is the exact opposite of what you just said, because if you think about, the parent has an incentive for this IPO to do well also. So my concern is kind of what Osman was saying, which is you're not going to get a real fair value here, because the situation that I see occurring, which I know will occur, is you buy this at a significant discount. The assets are unrealistically low. You go public with a company whose balance sheet has been stripped down. Your depreciation, your inventory costs are all unrealistically low. And you have sort of these fake profits for a period, and then the reality of the business sets in, and the parent benefits from a successful IPO. So I wouldn't be worried about an overpayment as much as I would be worried about an underpayment. And in that scenario, the 30% of public shareholders aren't going to complain because they're reaping the benefits initially. And that's my worry, is that you're not paying too much, you're paying too little for the subsidiary.
I'm not sure this is still the IPO scenario. This is irrelevant. The IPO is taken out.
It's an existing, okay, but the shareholders still benefit.
So the IPO, or already public, it's the same thing.
Because they transfer a company from, they own 100% over to something that they own 70% of. Why should they want to do that?
Because if you go public, you unlock value.
They are already public.
They're both public.
So I think the public ownership is...
But if this...
is public and IP1 is also public.
If you have 100% of something, why should you transfer that to something that you only own 70% of at
That's from the vantage point of the parent.
Yeah.
From the vantage point of the owner of IP1, who is making that acquisition. So are we talking about how IP1 treats the acquisition of S3, or how he treats the acquisition?
Well, IP1 treats
it. Right. So why would I? I'm more worried about the IP1's treatment of this transaction, which is, to me, their incentive is to underpay, right?
Yeah, their incentive is that they are majority owned by P. So P can say to them, this is the price.
There is a scenario where you would actually, you can see, there is a reasonable scenario where the parent will move something in at a lower price because the combined package increases their long-term value. It's you know, give them a discount on this, but then we get a bigger pop on the value. That's a real scenario.
Yeah, because if IP2 is not public and IP1 is.
If your marginal tax rate is higher than 34%, it's very simple to explain why you do that.
I think it's 1 minute of time, and this is a very exciting topic. Maybe we should have it again next time and spend a bit of time. And meanwhile, I would like you guys to think about and help us identify the respective information needs of shareholders in P and shareholders in IP1. There are different groups of people, most likely. And they have different objectives in terms of information, different needs, because they are faced with different risks. So I think if you could list what are the information needs of both shareholders in P and shareholders in IP1, and contrast those and see what kind of information is needed. Because there are two sets of financial statements here. One, the group P, and there is probably a set of sub-consolidated IP1 financial statements. In most cases, it will be required to produce consolidated financial statements at IP1 level.
Yeah.
And those serve different needs from the ones of P.
Exactly.
And probably what is done at IP1 is undone when you consolidate in P.
Exactly.
So I think we have to get this whole thing together and maybe come back to it at some point if staff is okay.
Okay. We finish this round. Carlos, please.
The second example made me think more about this.
Gentlemen.
I think it's obvious that there is a lot of space for playing with numbers. But companies do that all the time. They transfer assets between the group all the time. And most of the times, I prefer to know the number than, even if that number is not the true number, it's an actual transaction. They actually realize the transaction. There may be implications for minority shareholders in this case, which may raise corporate governance issues. There are tax implications. And if there is a tax implication, I would like to know what generated that tax implication. So even if that number is not a market-based number, I think it's good to know. There are cases of fraud that people play with assets around. And I guess it's easier to identify a fraud if you know the actual transaction. If you're not accounting for that transaction, you don't really know, right? You just know the book value of the old asset. So I know it's a totally different view, but
even if it's not the true number, you won't get the right return on invested capital. At least you know what's going on within the group.
Okay. And Mark, you hedge, or are you?
Yeah, I guess I was going to throw something else into the equation. Given the time available, I'll probably take it offline.
We go to Tanya?
Yeah, I was just going to, again, maybe too complicated to raise at this point, but I can see a possibility where you transfer the asset as P to P1, and you actually use that. If you were to take that at fair value, you could then probably transfer debt in order to get debt out of the wholly owned entity, now being IP2, to IP1, which is 30% owned by the shareholders. So again, I'm concerned about a transfer where you see that fair value, because there is an incentive perhaps for the parent to actually transfer at a higher value in order to perhaps allow a change of the structure of debt between IP2 to IP1.
Yeah. I think we have to... do you still have... We have 4 minutes left. Do you still have a question for us that we need to solve?
Yeah. I mean, in scenario 2A, the transaction being a related party transaction, we do understand that there is always a doubt whether the consideration exchanged is at fair value or not. But what we were trying to look at here is, from the 30% public's point of view, in scenario 2A, they get to see the fair values of S3. Whereas in scenario 2B, which is an external acquisition, they get to see the fair values of S3, the assets and liabilities, not the consideration part. But in scenario 2A, because that's presently out of the scope of IFRS 3, we were only trying to understand whether the 30% public would still want to look at the fair values of S3, which are now coming to the group, or they need the carryover values of S3 as it was before.
Economically, nothing, too little changed, I think. And you are not sure about the acquisition price. Yes, you lose 30% ownership of S3. You lose 30% ownership of S3. But you cannot be sure, unfortunately, that the transaction price is arm's length. Economically, too little changed. I think you should not record goodwill here in 2A.
For the shareholders in P, yes, but for the shareholders
in IP1, there is a
big change.
IP1 is a foreign transaction, so it's irrelevant. I think you should not look beyond the group. For IP1, you should record the bill.
So that's different.
Peter.
I just wanted to give my view of the question, and definitely S3 must be taken into the account at market values with goodwill and everything.
Into A,
yes.
Or IP1.
With 30% public ownership. The 30% public ownership is extremely important.
That's assuming that you have a strong market regulator that can protect that.
Or I have strong public ownership.
Or you have strong public ownership.
Yeah.
Which you didn't.
So, look, all we're doing is we're questioning. This was set up, so 30% was a presumption that it would be a market transaction. And the only thing is we're reflecting that in some jurisdictions that's a given, and in other jurisdictions it may not be. So when you write the standard, you need to sort of, you may not want to put a bright line 30% in there. That's, I think, all we're saying here.
I think one of the points that keeps getting lost, that whether the transaction is at market price or not, does not really impact the fair values of S3.
It does.
No.
Well, it does in the sense that who decides the fair values?
Right.
But in any case, regardless of whether you have an acquisition from a related party or unrelated, if you issue financial statements with fair values, presumably you will have auditors and human evaluators. So all I'm saying is that the transaction price itself does not impact on the fair values of the acquired entity.
The individual assets.
Yeah.
Very
didn't ask that.
We're going to wrap up here. It's 12:30. Any last comments from participants?
Robert.
I've been told I must make the comment. I'm just going to repeat. But I'm going to. We. You know, several of us are looking at 30% and saying it does matter whether it's a market transaction, and we're questioning whether it is a market transaction. Our answer changes if it isn't a market transaction. That's the point I was supposed to be making. We've said it before. We just need to say it again.
Yep.
Tanya's got a...
Oh, sorry, Tanya.
I was just going to say, maybe a way to answer the question is to pose another question. So if we looked at scenario 2A, if S3 then got moved back to IP2 at 2 or 3 years hence, what do we think the outcome would be? Again, you open up, don't you open up the possibility for the parent to just move assets internally around to generate internal goodwill?
So it sounds like maybe this is something we should come back to CMAC with.
Yeah.
Maybe.